Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Dismantle Ideas podcast with me, Matt Freemantle, a fellow inquisitive human. This episode is all about a little documentary called Spaceship Earth and an experiment which happened in the early 90s in 1991 called Biosphere 2. It came with its own controversies, so it was a group of eight people who were essentially locked in what is a massive, very high-tech and well-enclosed greenhouse for 2 years to show what it might be like if life ended up on another planet and to really test the environment within that. So there was no, you know, initially at least, there was no oxygen in there. It was very sort of self-sufficient. They had an ocean, they had waterfalls, they had lots of animals, their own crops in there. So it was a really, really groundbreaking and interesting experiment. On our show today, I have one of those scientists, Dr. Mark Nelson, who was one of the biospherians at the time. He's also written a number of books about his experience inside, one called Life Under Glass, which I read in preparation for this interview, and it's fascinating. Please do check it out. And another one called Pushing Our Limits. We had a truly, truly fascinating and wonderful discussion about not only Biosphere 2 and the experiment that it was and the project that led to it, but also about our planet, how we can give it a bit more kind of respect and look at it in a slightly different way, and how in fact we are all biospherians ourselves. We spoke about everything ranging from, you know, how we engage with the world around us, what we eat, the air we breathe, and also the waste that we produce. So it was an amazing and sideways look at how we live our lives, I guess. Anyway, without any further ado, I think it's probably best we just get on with the podcast, isn't it? So here it is, Dismantling Spaceship Earth, Lessons from Biosphere 2 with Dr. Mark Nelson. Hope you enjoy it as much as we did. So joining me on today's Dismantle Ideas podcast, we have scientist, biospherian, and you may know him from the recent documentary Spaceship Earth, and author of books including Life Under Glass, Dr. Mark Nelson. It's an absolute pleasure.
Likewise. Great to join you and your listeners.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It's honestly an honor to have you on. And you're over in New Mexico, right?
I am. We have an organic, well, we have Synergia Ranch for people who saw Spaceship Earth as an organic orchard and vegetable operation, publishing company, adobe buildings that we built from scratch in the early 70s, et cetera, and going strong after 50 years.
It's incredible. So you're as busy as ever then?
Yeah, busier.
Busier than ever. I think you said to me earlier this week when we were discussing this that the farming is becoming very it's a key peak time for you at the moment.
Oh, it is. Yeah, I mean, we're pushing kale and chard and beets and squash and you name it out the door at a dizzying rate, and it's so satisfying. This ties back, of course, to Biosphere 2 and our Beyond Organic Farm. But I take really great pleasure in working with nature, and, you know, nature tells you you're not in charge, but if you do things right and listen to us, you know, you'll get production and delivering really clean, beautiful food to our local communities and CSAs and co-ops is marvelous.
That's brilliant. It must be very fulfilling.
It is.
And was that always an interest of yours, even before you got involved with the whole sort of team at Biosphere 2?
Hell no. I'm a total New York City kid. First generation, my parents were born in Russia and Poland, you know, Jewish, upwardly mobile people, but totally, you know, totally city people. Although after I came to Synergia Ranch and my mom visited, my dad had passed away, she remembered growing food in Poland. And I'm sure my dad's family used to grow potatoes, make it into vodka, and that was one of their cash incomes. So I'm that far removed from being a good man of the earth and eco tiller.
Have you yourself turned potatoes into vodka recently?
No, I haven't. Actually, Sally Silverstone in Biosphere 2, we did a lot of home brewing because there was no liquor store to go to. So, but I'm not a brewer myself, not yet.
There's still time. There's still time. Yeah. So thank you so much for joining today, Mark. Obviously, everything's been brought into quite sharp focus with the release of the Spaceship Earth feature length documentary. Do you just want to, you know, in your own words, speak about, you know, how you got from where you did to being in Biosphere 2 and the sort of the journey that Spaceship Earth kind of presents?
Well, I have really good luck, I have to say. Maybe you'd say it's good karma. I had, you know, been in a family where all of the, you know, young boys were supposed to become doctors, and if not a doctor, at least a lawyer. And I went to Dartmouth College on a full scholarship and, you know, graduated summa cum laude. And my brother was already in medical school. And I knew that I wanted to do something more adventurous, more outside the envelope. And it was the beginning of the, you know, Earth Day was only a year or two in the future. Environmental concerns were on the horizon. And I ran into some people who had worked with the group, the Theater of All Possibilities, what later also became the Institute of Ecotechnics in New York. And they said, you know, they bought some land in New Mexico, and they're starting a community, and they're going to put into practice new ideas and new approaches. So I came out, I wrote a letter to John Allen. A letter, mind you. Got a letter back, and he said, you know, our deal is come for a 3-day trial period. And 3 days went to a month. I got put in charge of gardens and trees. We had begun rehabilitating a really ecologically devastated piece of land, typical for, unfortunately, not just the southwest of the U.S., but a lot of land and mismanagement that people do. So a few years later, we started an Institute of Ecotechnics, and that kind of, you know, I think speaks to what our concern was even back in the early 70s, is we knew that there was a conflict between business as usual, as we call it now, the world of technology, including how we farm and ranch and do pretty much everything, and the world of life, the eco. So we wanted to start a new discipline. And we got registered in the UK, and we still operate both in the UK and in the US. And we consult to innovative projects in challenging biomes around the planet. So for people who know that this story is going to go to Biosphere 2, who saw the film or remember the project, it was perfect preparation because we had ground truth and learning by doing. And, you know, finding appropriate mentors and people at all skills levels. We had projects going in the rainforest in the tropical savanna of Australia, where I spent about 10 years starting the project. In the World City in London, the October Gallery. Anyone in the who comes to London should check it out. We're very happening Transvanguard Gallery. So I got involved. I was a co-founder of Ecotechnics. And since 1982, I've been its chairman. And we consult to these projects. We have alliances with like-minded communities and endeavors and outstanding people. And we put together for about 25 years annual conferences where we got to meet our heroes, you know, some of the leading scientists, engineers, thinkers, artists. We always believe that art and science should not be bifurcated. So that was the, you know, kind of straight, non-straight path that got me from New York City and Dartmouth College to going in Biosphere 2 in 1991.
Quite the journey.
And it goes on. We have a saying actually from a John Allen poem, to keep the voyage going, going, and never gone.
I love that. I love that. It's amazing to see you still taking all of this work into your life still now. It's fantastic. I mean, I mentioned briefly earlier that Spaceship Earth had brought the whole thing, the whole experiment, your whole group into focus again. Do you think the documentary has generally had a positive or a negative effect?
Oh, I think it's been very, very positive. I have a few quibbles, but, you know, they wanted to do a four-part series. So in a two-hour film, it's amazing how much ground they covered, and you can't do everything. But, you know, and looking at you, Matt, I can see you're of a generation who is, you know, probably learning to walk or talk when Biosphere 2 happened. And yeah, and for that generation, you know, they kind of missed, it was a worldwide phenomena. And I think one of the legacies of Biosphere 2 is that it reached hundreds of millions of people, and it gave them an optimistic premise that humans can learn to live with a biosphere in a very sustainable, beautiful way. Of course, there were problems because we were jumping into, oh gosh, a whole whale of unknowns. But that was the whole point of the excitement of the project. So that the film is now bringing that story to, a whole new generation and to a new time on planet Earth. Because what we were concerned with and what motivated our work from the 70s and in Biosphere 2 is now front page news. It is, everybody knows we're in trouble. We have to change the way we do things, the way we think about the biosphere. So I just love that Matt Wolf, Stacey Reese, and the other producers, you know, made this labor of love, and it's a very inspirational film.
Are you still in contact with most of or any of the group that you were in Biosphere 2 with?
Yeah, no, I'm in contact with all of them. And in fact, we had a wonderful 25th reunion. We called it re-entry after the 2 years when we opened the airlock and came back to Earth. And it was quite a momentous moment, I'll tell you, because in that first breath, I knew that Biosphere 2 was a different world. It smelled different. Everything was different about it. Yeah, so we had a great reunion, and I am going to plug and I'm going to hold up. There's a new edition of Life Under Glass. So if people are interested in Biosphere 2, you know, take Spaceship Earth as an hors d'oeuvre. This will get you much deeper into it. And I co-wrote it with two of the other crew, Gay Alling and Sally Silverstone. So we published the first edition, actually, as we were coming out of Biosphere 2. It's now updated with research highlights and a introduction where we look at the relevance and the importance of Biosphere 2 for our current situation. So it is the best book for getting your mind around what was it like to live with seven other people for 2 years in a separate world.
Amazing. As we've spoken before, I've admittedly, hand on heart, I haven't read the whole thing, but I've read a good few chapters now, and I can totally back up what you've said. It's fascinating, and you know, we were talking about the human relationships and the human side of it, and how those relationships developed. And you know, I think John Allen stated before you guys went in, and this is in the book as well, humans were the most unstable element of Biosphere 2. We're always going to be the most unstable element of Biosphere 2. Did that end up ringing true?
Yeah, but let me just do a little fact check. We got a telex from the Russians, the then Soviets, who are by far the leaders in space life support and closed ecological systems, and a wonderful, wonderful scientist from a Moscow Space Institute, Yevgeny Shepalev. He was the first man to ever spend 24 hours in a closed ecological system. His only companions was a big vat of green algae, which was regenerating water and air. He could only eat about 1 ounce of it. So he was the one who sent, when we were about to put John Allen's human experiment in a little test module, you know, a tiny version of Biosphere 2 that we did to test a lot of the engineering, how to make a building airtight, et cetera. So he sent that message, and it ended with, you know, remember, humans are the most unstable element in the ecosystem. have courage. And yeah, I think that's true. And the human aspect of living in Biosphere 2 was one, the most joyous, but was also the most problematical. And I had lived, as I mentioned, you know, way in the outback of the Kimberley region of West Australia, up in the north, you know, where you are not physically isolated, but you feel like you dropped off the end of the earth. Mm-hmm. You know, we had modern communications. We could pick up a phone and call friends, colleagues, et cetera, et cetera. We could beat people at the glass. But just being confined with seven other people, as wonderful a group as those seven other people were, that's difficult. And I'm reminded of, you know, we all have a theater background, people who came through the synergias and became synergists. There's a wonderful Sartre play called No Exit. And in it, one character says, "Hell is other people." So, you know, and that's a reality. I mean, we're all human. We know dysfunctional family gatherings. We know personality disorders. There's also cabin fever. And there was a power struggle, which the film captures, that was raging during the 2 years about the direction and management of the project. So that helped polarize the crew. Yet despite that, we worked together amazingly well. Roy Walford, our in-house physician, as it were, said, "Sometimes I couldn't stand them, but we were a hell of a team." And I think that also speaks, that gives me hope. You know, even when there's conflict and, you know, factionalism, if you are united in a purpose, and the purpose was to make Biosphere 2 as successful and scientifically fruitful as possible, is literally your lifeboat. Your health depends on the health of the system. What happens often in expeditions and in human groups, subconscious sabotage never happened. We all loved Biosphere 2, and we knew if anything imperiled the health of Biosphere 2, we were in trouble.
You wouldn't want anything to go wrong in there, would you?
No, you know, and is it time to say one of the lessons of Biosphere 2? And it's hard, you know, it's hard for probably most of your younger listeners to remember. But when we started the project, which started in 1984, it took 7 years of design and construction and brainstorming and figuring out innovative ecology and technology. The word biosphere was really unknown. We had to spell the word biosphere to people because they didn't know what it was. So how has the world changed? I mean, people said, "Oh, you're 50 years ahead of your time." If we were to build Biosphere 2 now and say, we need to study biospheres because it's our life support system, and we need to study how to redesign technologies so people can meet their needs, and, you know, you need an infrastructure if you're going to make an artificial world, people would totally get it. And that's why we, you know, thank goodness the engineers wanted to make it a big box store like a Walmart or Target, or I'm not sure the British equivalent. And our architects said, hell no. You know, even though we intended it to be a quiet research project, if we have the hubris or the daring, the audacity to attempt to make the first, you know, human-made biosphere, it's going to be beautiful. And as it turned out, how wonderful it was, because people who come to the biosphere or even see its images are kind of exalted. A friend who's in the film, Tony Burgess, once called Biosphere 2 a cathedral to Gaia. And there was kind of that sense, you know, we're all children of Gaia. We're all children of Mother Earth. We're children of Earth's biosphere. You know, so there was a great deal of humility involved in even when you're daring, it's good to be humble.
It really was a beautiful structure, wasn't it? It was fantastic, even just to look at, not to mention what was inside, but just, it must have been a pretty awesome sight to be just about to enter that fantastic building. And then, yeah, I mean, that must have taken some work.
Oh, it was astonishing. I mean, you know, almost everything, you know, we look back, oh yeah, so they went, well, we're inside for 2 years, the second crew was in there, blah, blah, blah. there was nothing certain about Biosphere 2, and almost every step of it was considered impossible. You know, for example, there were roughly 6,000 glass panes on the space frame, each about a meter and a half in dimension. And it was so hot in the Arizona sun that our people, the glaziers, putting in the glass and sealing it, they had to work at night. And it turned out that our crew was mostly rock climbers, you know, who were pretty comfortable with being, you know, Biosphere 2 as a human construction is pretty awesome because we planned the experiment for 100 years, and the 100-year experiment is still operating. That's another story. So it was done, you know, with state-of-the-art technology at the time.
In the book, it says, you know, there were 7 one-week mini trials before you went into Biosphere 2 proper. How did they go? And were there any huge learning curves or curveballs that you didn't expect to have to deal with?
No, you know, I mean, we've been training. There was a cadre of, we call them Biospherian candidates, who are operating prototype systems. And then, you know, one of the first things that actually went into Biosphere 2 before closure was the farm. So we were actually growing crops in there. I vividly remember after I was offered a place in the first crew, and I think it was the first meal of food grown in Biosphere, I bit into some, or, you know, took a chew of some peas and, you know, almost lost a tooth because there was a small stone which was exactly the size of these peas. So the, you know, the screens didn't pull it out. So, you know, there was an enormous learning curve. You know, I'd been already, you know, I planted the orchard at Sinigir Ranch. We did farming at virtually all of our projects. But to actually grow all of your food and look at a table and know intimately every food, how it got there from planting to weeding to harvesting to threshing to preparing in the kitchen, it was pretty awesome. You know, there were the little things that drove people crazy. I mean, there was a divided opinion. I think all the Biospherians were coffee drinkers. Yeah. So during the closure experiment, until finally some of the later ones, there was no outside ingredients allowed. But some people said, you know, we're going to drink coffee basically until we go inside Biosphere 2. I decided I didn't really want to go into withdrawal in my first days. So I and a few others, you know, stopped drinking coffee, and we didn't even have black tea inside. We had herbal teas inside. So, you know, the little vices, the little pleasures like caffeine, you know, it's a shock if you're really a heavy coffee drinker to suddenly go cold turkey.
I bet it was extremely satisfying to know that every single thing that you'd eaten whilst you were in there was grown by your hand and cultivated by your group. It sounds like, you know, something that we don't have the luxury of much in modern day society. Well, I mean, we could do if we had an allotment, or if we were so inclined. I'm sure you do now. Did you ever feel like you were just sort of on a merry-go-round of constant production and constant eating and constant production and constant eating?
You know, it could have been worse. I mean, Kevin Kelly, executive editor at Wired, he was one of the founders of Coevolution Quarterly. And he was a huge fan. He actually spent 24 hours in our test module, et cetera, written about Biosphere 2. But his fear was that we would turn into eco-peasants and we would be out there 7, 9, 10 hours a day. As it turned out, you know, on average, crew spent between 3 and 4 hours, 5 days a week on the agriculture. Of course, you know, Sally and Jane, who were more involved in it, spent some more hours, but it wasn't as onerous as you'd think. And it was astonishingly good. The only problem was calorie. Our doctor, who is a world expert in nutrient-dense, calorie-restricted diets, he was ecstatic. We were hungry. And so it motivated us to become way better farmers. The second year, we grew about 3 tons more food. We packed food, and I was leading the charge. We call them victory gardens, what American households did during World War II when so many farmers were away. They grew about 30% of the nation's vegetables. So we put plants everywhere there was sunfall that wasn't being utilized by a crop. And also all the plants were helping keep the CO2 down. So, you know, I've always been a tree hugger from way back, but I have a special in Biosphere 2, our close connection, and I hope we have a chance to talk about that at more length, was one of the amazing parts of it. You know, instead of just thinking ecologically and, you know, blah, 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 your body got it. You know, you're down to your cellular level. You understood that you were a part of this biosphere and you took, you know, loving care of it. You did your job. Our job was to be kind of the personal assistance to all the life inside Biosphere 2. You might express it. And it was wonderfully satisfying.
Sounds like a fantastic sort of connection you must have built with everything and everyone inside the biosphere. Do you wish that, you know, people today could experience even just a little bit of that connection with their living world around them?
Yeah, totally. I mean, when I give talks or write books or, you know, whatever, I mean, one of the points that I really make about, you know, what can we learn from Biosphere 2 is that reality that I was just describing, that is equally true for everybody listening to this broadcast. And it doesn't really matter if you're in a world city, in an office, you know, sequestered and quarantined at home, you are part of the biosphere and you couldn't have a breath of sustainable air, a drop of clean water or food without the action of the biosphere. And so, you know, to me, one of the great illusions is, and it's an unfortunate word that I try to avoid using, the environment makes it sound like here's you or me, or the human society, and the environment is something outside and alien to us. And that is not the case. You know, people talk about children, you know, the last walk in the woods. What do they call it? Nature separation. And that's an illusion. We are part of nature. We're both a child of the biosphere, and we are metabolically, intimately connected with it. And that's a wonderful reality. It's much better than the illusion that, you know, we're an island.
You said that one of the things, or one of the main issues from being inside the biosphere was the sheer amount of physical labor and how daunting that must have been. What were the biggest physical challenges you faced when you were inside Biosphere 2?
Well, you know, farming... And we didn't have very many. We had some machines to help thresh wheat and grains and this and that, but a lot of it was pretty primitive. Because one is we have 8 people working for your American listeners, a half acre farm. That's 1/5 of a hectare. So it was intensive agriculture, you know, par excellence. And, you know, but some of the labor, you know, if you really got into it, and I think we all got into it, for example, you know, I'd been to Asia, spent time in Bali, et cetera, et cetera. We planted rice seedlings pretty much like they do in Asia, barefoot, you know, in the muck. We'd raise the rice seedlings, you know, putting them carefully and progressing across a muddy field, a muddy rice paddy. You know, so there was a lot of labor, but because everything in Biosphere 2 made sense, you know, as good as my life is, you know, working in an ecotechnic project, you know, as somebody in the modern world, I mean, we wind up doing all kinds of things that we have no idea why we're doing them, except it's required. So one of the reasons that I and several other first crew told management, we'll go back in for a second closure or a future one, because it was amazing. It was amazing to be in a world where every action counted. There was no small anonymous actions, and everything made sense. And everything was designed to keep our biosphere healthy, keep ourselves healthy, and maximize the science. There was a lot of work, but because we had restricted calories and then as the oxygen decline advanced, you know, we couldn't have worked all day if we wanted to. In fact, people, you know, friends on the outside, family said, you know, looking at you guys work is like you're slightly in slow motion. And it's a beautiful thing that your body, when it knows that it's got limited resources, food and oxygen, it, you know, it spontaneously conserves energy and does things efficiently and, you know, not with undue haste.
It seemed to cause quite a stir when oxygen was pumped in for the first time in about 18 months. Was it about 18 months in? Why do you think everybody was so up in arms about that? And obviously as well, the other question is, how did it feel when that oxygen was pumped in?
Well, first off, you know, Biosphere 2, the biggest mistake, and I was a director of the project as well as a biospherian, is that we put out press releases talking about the goal of the project, you know, to make a world that is completely separate, where there's no inputs or outputs. But that was a long-term goal. And, you know, privately, we called the first closure, the two-year experiment, the shakedown. And a lot of our IT people who are looking at data from Biosphere 2 and from our test module, they didn't think we could stay in there through the first winter because CO2 would rise dramatically. So if I had to do one thing over, I would have emphasized, and we did privately in meetings, all of the unknowns, all of the disasters and, well, not disasters, but all of the unforeseen and challenging things that could happen. And what to me was beautiful about oxygen was that none of our consultants had ever said they worried about CO2 big time. We all did. Nobody ever said, well, maybe oxygen will kind of mysteriously disappear from the air inside Biosphere 2. So it was not a failure. It was actually a reinforcement of why we did it. But the media had kind of seized on a very simplified explanation of Biosphere 2. It was a space colony precursor. And the whole point was, could we stay in there, survive, and nothing goes in or out for 2 years? And that was never the intention of the project. So when the oxygen got put in, and you can still read endless, you know, media sensational headlines that prove that Biosphere 2 is a failure, you know, the experiment is over because they had to do that. No, you know, we had a tightly sealed system that, you know, just blew people. I was doing interface with space agencies. NASA's closed system down at Kennedy Space Center was leaking air, exchanging air with the outside 5 to 10% per day. We had less than 1% per month, which was really vital. If we had the kind of leakage that other closed systems had, we wouldn't have even seen the oxygen decline because it was declining that slow. So, you know, kudos to our innovative engineers for achieving the impossible. And, you know, so I think Spaceship Earth well captures the media frenzy of, you know, these issues about perfect sealing. But that was that, you know, that would have made Biosphere 2 a very, very expensive stunt and a very implausible stunt that you know, face so many unknowns and it's going to work perfectly. In fact, the surprising thing is that we did stay in there, albeit with using some seed stocks for food and the oxygen insertion for 2 years. And so many things worked as planned. I mean, a lot of ecologists thought we couldn't maintain, in, you know, under the same roof, a rainforest, a savanna grassland, a coastal desert, a mangrove wetland, a living coral reef ocean. They thought it would all be invaded by invasive species and homogenize. I started a previous book, Pushing Our Limits, which kind of pulled together a lot of the science with the most amazing physiological experience I've ever had was walking from that oxygen decline That's equivalent, by the way, to being on a 4,500 meter mountain, 14 to 15,000 feet in English terms. Suddenly walking into it, we wanted to very carefully measure exactly how much oxygen was put in. So we stepped into one of our variable volume lung buildings, which had had its door closed. We stepped into 29%, I believe it was, oxygen. And in seconds, I felt, you know, I had transformed from a 100-year-old to a 15-year-old. And, you know, all of the crew that were in there, we started laughing like crazy and running madly around that lung structure. And I realized, you know, hearing running feet was something I hadn't heard like in a year. So it was astonishing. And, you know, so Biosphere 2 also, for the crew and for people who really contemplate its lessons, there's so much that we take for granted that our biosphere does. You know, when Jim Lovelock and Lynn Margulis, you know, who came up with Gaia theory, and Jim was very much involved with NASA, you know, the first landings on Mars. How do you look for a habitable planet? Well, one of the ones, if alien life is anything like Earth life, is does it have a breathable atmosphere? And for the early history of the Earth, until you know, life is the ultimate engineer and technologist, until life figured out photosynthesis, there wasn't free oxygen. Free oxygen was a poison, because everything previously were anaerobic, were organisms that are killed by oxygen. So the fact that we have a 20, almost 21% oxygen atmosphere is totally, take a bow, biosphere. The green plants of our biosphere are responsible for that. So, you know, I don't take breath and air, you know, casually anymore. You know, everyone talks about mindfulness. And I think one of the most profound mindfulness is to, you know, really get in touch with your body and, you know, start to understand how inseparable you are from our biosphere, including that famous, you know, stop, listeners, hold your breath, exhale. Now appreciate that the biosphere has put the oxygen into your next breath of air.
I think that's such a lovely, lovely sentiment. I live in a big city. I live in London. Everyone's very busy all the time. I don't think anyone feels particularly connected to nature as such. But we do try. You know, I've got a park very close by that I try and get out to, but there's no real sort of countryside or proper nature that is handily available to me. So I think that's a great takeaway, if among many others, and we're just getting started, which is great. You know, you said that you felt more connected when you were in there because of your closeness to your whole environment and the whole biosphere that you found yourself in during Biosphere 2. Did you come out a changed man, and how was it coming back into the, in inverted commas, real world after that?
Yeah, it was pretty astonishing, and I've looked a few times. I guess actually there's a clip from my, you know, we all had prepared a little bit of a reentry speech when we came out, and we were honored. You know, Jane Goodall was there. You know, Oleg Gizenko, the head of the most important space institute in Russia, was there. It was a pretty amazing experience. And there's a moment when I stepped up to the platform and I sort of took in two things. One is that, you know, you don't see stars very well inside a glass structure. We could see fireworks, but they weren't that spectacular. But the horizon is kind of washed out. And I remember just looking out and, you know, it's at kind of the foothills of some mountains, the site of Biosphere 2. And it was just so pleasurable to look at the various spectra of light and look out into, you know, the kind of horizons that you get, you know, outside on planet Earth. And the other thing is there was probably a couple of thousand people there. And to feel the energy and emotional, you know, connection with other people, that was one of our strongest hungers inside, aside from wishing for food that we couldn't produce and drink that we couldn't brew was, oh my God, wouldn't I love to be at a party and meet strangers, rather than these wonderful, but oh my God, the same seven faces at, 2,160, I believe, meals during the 2 years. So it was quite incredible. And I know the clip in Spaceship Earth is living in a small world changes who you are. And it really does. We're the first generation that really understand that the Earth is pretty limited. It's more tightly sealed than Biosphere 2. What was revolutionary about Biosphere 2 in such a small system where everything cycles really rapidly, there's no way. You can't throw anything away. It's going to come back. If we were stupid enough to pollute our water, it would literally be in our cups of herbal tea in 2 or 3 weeks. CO2 is coming in and out of the atmosphere, every 4 to 6 hours. But there's no way on planet Earth. And we're the first generation, beginning to understand that. And that's going to inform our technology and our engineering if we're going to have a successful future, which I believe we will.
How do you best teach people that they are, in fact, also biospherians and to look after what we currently have? Is there a silver bullet? Is there a teaching or a learning that can be easily conveyed to today's modern society, wasteful, sort of slightly blasé at times society?
I wish there were, and part of the dream of Biosphere 2, and the fat lady hasn't sung, is that Biosphere 2 would give rise to Biosphere 3, 4, 5, 10, 100, 500, in all kinds of shapes and configurations. And, one of my dreams was that, before a G8 or G10, whatever it is, or United Nations General Assembly, that all the world leaders would go into biospheric systems and experience their connection with life and understand that taking care of our biosphere is not something that we should only do when we feel affluent and virtuous. It's like survival. It is literally survival. And I wish that there were a magic way for people to get that insight. I love a quote from Stephen Jay Gould, the ecologist and anthropologist. He wrote, "We have to fall in love with the earth because we will not fight to defend what we're not in love with." And, so I say to people, and it's interesting from what I read about the quarantine, is people are now buying up seeds like crazy, planting houseplants and little, vegetables on their windowsills. They're getting enamored with the trees that they might see outside their apartment or house. And by all means, I grew up in New York City. I grew up in Queens, which has some spectacular parks. And I just defy it. You have to be a really damaged human being to get out in Central Park or Russell Square or, London and England is full of huge trees. Europe is quite blessed and a lot of the United States is. Get out into nature and really experience how much you are at peace, how much better your organism feels. There's a fancy word for it that E.O. Wilson invented, biophilia. This is this innate love of life that every human being has. We grew up in nature. Being urbanized and citified is like a really recent development. And, so I love that there's big movements now to green cities. I worked with a guy from NASA who is one of the leaders in indoor air quality, Billy Wolverton. So getting plants into every space actually not only will make you feel better, but they will purify the air and you won't have a sick building syndrome. So one way or another, get out of the illusion that you're separate from nature. And experience it. Experience, there's got to be a tree, close to you. Go and grok, as the 60s people like I am say, go and commune, meditate, be mindful around a green plant or a tree. Talk to it. Listen to it.
I think that's a really lovely idea of getting world leaders into a Biosphere 2 type situation. I mean, the likelihood of actually getting them inside one of them probably seems slim, unfortunately, whilst it is a fantastic idea. Could you imagine someone like a Donald Trump inside Biosphere 3?
Well, yeah, I could. Why not?
How do you think he'd get on?
Well, who knows? I did preface that thing that, if you're sufficiently damaged, by trauma, by mental illness, by, there are some people who, unfortunately, and I actually blame, I think we need to rechange. I love that your podcast is basically called Dismantle, because I think we need to dismantle how we live on planet Earth, and really radically reimagine what life can be, how cities can be. But the fact is that modern, especially capitalist, big corporate, multinational corporations, that economics has so little to do and has so little reverence or respect for nature that we have to rethink. Let's reinvent an economic system that actually supports nature, including human nature. When we destroy nature, we're also destroying part of ourselves because we are so bonded with it. So, yeah, dismantle and reboot. I don't know what Donald Trump would do in Biosphere 2. Probably improve his mood. Maybe he wouldn't tweet for a while.
He'd definitely have to not have access to his Twitter, I think. You talk about dismantling the way that we perhaps live in our own actual biosphere that we're all in at the moment. If someone put you in charge tomorrow, if you suddenly had a position of power with the US government, for example, how would you, and what sort of first initial steps do you think you would try and make to try and improve the situation at the moment? What would be your first goal?
There are so many problems with what we do. I mean, one of the most terrifying ones is the use of chemicals that really have not been tested either for human safety or for environmental impact. And this is a good time to say, part of our vision about closed ecological systems, and our Russian colleagues are right there with us, is we should be using the precautionary principle. So when I learned that the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, has only banned in its history less than 10 chemicals, and virtually all chemicals that were in common use were presumed to be safe. So I would say let's build, and they don't need to be as elaborate as Biosphere 2. They could have just one ecosystem with a lot of diversity. And let's use that as a testing thing for new chemicals, new technologies. I don't know what to think about GMOs. It makes me a bit nervous, but what really makes me nervous is that they haven't been studied in nature. So this would be a perfect use for Biosphere 3, 6, 13. Release GMO organisms in there and study, what they're doing.
How do you think Biosphere 3 would look if you were to start planning it tomorrow? And in fact, actually, how about Biosphere 10, for example? Do you think they'd all be wildly different, or do you think they'd all be pretty similar with a few tweaks here and there?
By the way, Biosphere 2 gave rise to a Japanese facility. It's called CEEF, C-E-E-F, Closed Ecological Experimental Facility, up in northern Japan. And it's very close to a nuclear plant. So they've used it kind of like I was talking about. They've put radioactive materials into that, into their system. They used to call it Biosphere J, either for junior, because it's smaller than Biosphere 2, or Biosphere Japanese, to see and study what radioactive materials move. And before the Soviet Union kind of imploded and went bankrupt, the people we were working with, they were really keen to do a Russian biosphere. And listen to this. So Biosphere 2, we tried to make is absolutely pollution-free, clean technology based as possible. What the Russians said was, that's really good, but let's use our biosphere in a different way because our country is really polluted. So the Russian biosphere was going to be, first of all, it would be temperate. Maybe you'd have tundra instead of savanna. Biosphere 2 was tropical or semi-tropical, but for example, if one was done in London or in England, it would make sense to use temperate ecosystems. But the Russians said, we will start with a very polluted biosphere. We'll intentionally make the soils polluted, the waters, et cetera. And then we'll use that biosphere as a way to study how to clean up those ecosystems as kind of a laboratory for regeneration and bioremediation of these pollutants. So there's almost an infinite way that you can move and configure biospheres. And you could make smaller ones that would be research modules. After Biosphere 2, we created what we call the laboratory biosphere here in New Mexico. And it's of a size that would fit in the cargo bay of the shuttle. It's got high intensity lights and, soils in there for air purification, et cetera. So it's a field that's really very malleable. And what we were hoping Biosphere 2 would kick off would be, let's take very seriously how to study biospheres and comparative biospheres. So each biosphere that got made would be another example of a comparative biosphere. So they could be, in a way, talking to each other, and the data from all of these biospheres could be assessed and compared with similar processes on planet Earth. And, for people out there who are not scientists, I mean, real scientists know that as much as we know about nature, science basically means the investigation of nature. As much as we know about ecology, planet Earth, the universe, there's so much that we don't know. And, so science is an ongoing endeavor. And, when people say, oh, geez, Biosphere 2 is so expensive, of course, it was the first of its kind. And, we had to do a lot of research and development that we wouldn't for future biospheres. But $200 million is the cost of one military aircraft, one, military jet. With the stakes that we face in learning how to live sustainably, regeneratively with planet Earth, these are really modest investments.
When you put it into context like that, it's an absolute no-brainer, I think. 200 million, as crazy as it sounds as a figure to you or I, perhaps, or to the average Joe in the street, myself included in that brandishing. But into comparison, if you can buy a fighter jet, then surely it can be invested more wisely for future generations to actually benefit from something.
I guess what's unusual is that ecologists and life scientists work on really skimpy budgets. And I think a little bit of the jealousy that Biosphere 2 invoked in some scientists was, we had this amazing apparatus to work with, to play with, to experiment with. But when you think that a cyclotron, and I think all types of science, they don't need to be pragmatic and give cost benefit analysis, but a cyclotron might cost $10 billion or more. $10 billion, and let's say we can get the cost of a biosphere down to $50 million, that's 20 in a billion. You could do 200 biospheres for the cost of a cyclotron. And, the one good thing about the change of directions, the University of Arizona now operates Biosphere 2. Columbia University did for 5 or 6 years in the late 90s. Is they kind of used it as a biospheric university. So I think every city should have a biosphere of some sort. Every major university should have one, both for research, public education, inspiration. If we can't get the G8 members in there, how about, people who win certain lotteries could go into a biosphere for a week. Your top students, it'd be a great incentive. Put kids from minority schools, disadvantaged kids, You know, there should be ones in every continent, all over the planet. I mean,
that would be really incredible.
Yeah. And make it available. I mean, maybe instead of a live-in crew, maybe you'd have a couple, you know, like on a training ship, you have a couple of experienced biospherians in there. And then, you know, you'd have a rotating crew to give as many, you know, kids, adults, seniors, whatever, the experience of it, a taste of it. Because I have to say, you know, the only reason that I put my hand up to start biospherian training is I spend 24 hours in that test module. And the first 2 or 3 minutes in that test module absolutely just rocked my boat. It turned my universe inside out because I understood that my body was not getting it the way my mind was. And for your body to understand that connection, to experience it beyond words, really. I mean, all I can do is put some words on an experience that was deep in the body, deep in the body. And you look, you know, what's beautiful about a closed system is we may know theoretically that, you know, like I was talking about the oxygen that the biosphere produces. In a biosphere, you could actually walk around or in that test module, basically just look around. And you could see all the green plants, and immediately you understand they're waiting for my next outbreath of CO2, and they're putting the oxygen in the air for me.
Would you go back in if you had a choice, or if you had the option to go back in? If someone approached you and said, right, we're building Biosphere 3, we want a Biosphere 2 veteran in there, someone who knows what they're talking about and someone who we believe is going to really help us, you know, make this project a success. Would you go back in?
I would say yes, in faster than a nanosecond, faster than the speed of light. I have dreams of it, by the way. And I know a lot of my fellow, both first mission and second mission people, I often have dreams that we are going back into a biosphere, either Biosphere 2 or a new one. And like, you know, I love that they called that film Spaceship Earth, because Buckminster Fuller was a huge inspiration. We had the pleasure of having him at conferences and counting him as a friend. And, you know, his seminal book was called Operating Manual for Spaceship Earth. And it, that title, you know, kind of says it all. He says, you know, we're on this amazingly wealthy, beautiful, you know, 4 billion year old planet. And the striking thing is that we humans don't have an operating manual of how to behave, how to manage ourselves. It's not like we have to manage the biosphere. We mainly have to manage humanity, you know, starting with ourselves. So, yeah, I mean, in those dreams, it's like, uh-oh, you know, I'm not sure that I actually even know what I'm stepping into. And the beautiful thing, you know, we were not biospherians. I think being a biospherian is like being an artist. Or being a you know, in my culture, a mensch, that's both in Yiddish and German, for a real human being. You know, but during the 2 years, we were on the learning curve of how to become biospherians. And the real humor to me is when the bankers, the banksters and the lawyers took over Biosphere 2, that they were madly running around looking for the operating manual. Well, the operating manual was in the bodies and the minds, both of the crew inside and a lot of our key consultants and, you know, people working with us in mission control. That's where the operating manual was. And that's, you know, kind of, it was a beautiful thing to learn how to live with Biosphere 2 and figure out, you know, how to manage our activities, you know, to maximize our positive interaction with that system. And to take that to the outside. So that was one of the shocks of coming outside, is that from a world where everything made sense and it was so palpable that, you know, you had to really make sure that you did the right thing. You're out in this world where I can see why people think it's hopeless. You know, I read all these depressing headlines. I'm just one person. Does it really matter if I recycle or if I, you know, get a hybrid or, you know, walk or bike to work instead of driving a car? You know, we have to change that mindset. And one of the things that inspired me in Biosphere 2 is that I was the sewage manager. I was in charge of the constructed wetland that treated all of our domestic waste, both from the people and the animals. And I love that system because we were doing it in a very green way, as a beautiful wetland with flowering plants, etc. So I went back to university to get a PhD and make these, I call them now wastewater gardens. People need to have ways of being reconnected. So I also wrote a book called The Wastewater Gardener, and I love the subtitle we came up with, Preserving the Planet One Flush at a Time. And so we would make these constructed wetlands, and we've now put them into about 14 countries. And I love that the people who have one, whether it's a hotel, a restaurant, a house, a business, they start falling in love with the wetland plants out there. And they understand that they have to be careful not to use nasty chemicals that'll go out because that could damage the plants. And, you know, so it gives them a mindfulness and a connection. So just like we were talking about air, try to find out where your drinking water and your water supply comes from, and where do the waste that leave your house or apartment go? Get connected with those processes. And then once we get connected with them, then we might say, that's really awful. Almost every sewage plant in the world, high-tech one, dumps its partially treated waste into an ocean, a river, or groundwater. That is really sad. That's a waste.
It's shocking.
It's a waste of fresh water, and it's a waste of the nutrients that they contain. So, you know, our goal when we do these wastewater gardens is to absolutely reuse, and plants and microbes are nature's perfect recyclers. They will take your waste and make beauty and usable products and beautiful plants out of it.
Going back a little bit to what you said about the, if people were to go into the biosphere too now, the manual was within the people that essentially built it and essentially made it what it was. Do you think there's a takeaway to be had that actually, you know, going from everything that we've discussed, do you think the manual is within everybody that's living in this biosphere, and therefore the more people connect to it, the more of a future this planet's got?
Potentially, yes. And actually, you're reminding me that one of the beautiful things about Biosphere 2, which was crucial to it actually being as successful as it was, is that we had to attract top ecologists and top and innovative engineers. And I realized, you know, working and sitting in on these design meetings, that ecologists really rarely get to sit down with engineers and vice versa. I mean, my joke at the time was that these two groups couldn't even insult each other because they were speaking different languages. So the ecologists, you know, usually when they hear the engineers are coming there, oh, my God, my beautiful forest, they're going to put a road through it, a bridge through it, you know. There's going to be a housing development. And the engineers, you know, they love really solving problems, you know, making elegant use of technology. But they very rarely get called upon to consider the entire ecological context. So like a spacecraft, every material and technology that got put into Biosphere 2 was kind of pre-screened for what was its, you know, byproducts. What pollution would it cause, and could the biosphere absorb and neutralize it? And some, you know, so some solutions, though they were nice for the engineers, had to be rejected. And the engineers, they kind of mutinied because they realized that all the engineering that they were producing, which was really awesome and stunning, was not going to keep Biosphere 2 healthy. Biosphere 2 is going to be kept healthy by its life. You know, so the engineering was kind of playing second fiddle. It was certainly necessary. You know, we didn't have a world climate system. We had to do that with engineering, you know, make waterfalls happen, you know, recirculate streams, you know, do a thousand things like that. But all of that was just in the service of life. And it had to pass that test that it couldn't pollute the biosphere. You know, one telling example was, if you're going to have a living ocean and coral reef, you need to have a tide. And, you know, so here we are at 1,000 meters, 3,900 feet, you know, in the foothills of the mountains in Arizona. We're crazy enough that we're going to put an Everglades marsh, a tropical rainforest, and a living coral reef in there. And the engineers, you know, were naysayed when they came up with pumps to produce that, because conventional pumps would have taken all of our fish and other marine biota and pulverized them. And so digging deep and understanding the context, they came up with vacuum pumps. So they gently lifted up, I think it was something on the order of 10,000 gallons, 40,000 liters of water into a chamber, and then released it to produce gentle tides. So I think that, you know, part of our re-education and dismantling of our infrastructure is every ecologist should learn engineering, and every engineer should be deeply versed in ecology. And that should be a requirement.
Would you say that's kind of one of the main take homes from the work with Biosphere 2 then, and putting that into some sort of blueprint for the future?
Yeah, you know, we haven't mentioned the Anthropocene, either way apparently is correct. You know, people are beginning to, and geologists are considering, we're in a new geologic era. And it's sort of obvious, you know, the main factor, you're saying humans are the most, or, you know, the Russian soul is humans are the most unstable element in the ecosystem. Well, humans are also kind of a geologic force in our modern biosphere by our numbers, by the materials that we use, by, you know, by all of our activities, you know, and, you know, living or thinking about our biosphere without really getting your mind around human activity. Cities are ecosystems. There was a wonderful series of UN conferences. I gave some talks at the ones that were in Australia. Cities are ecosystems as well. And they're, you know, what happens in cities kind of shapes what happens on the planet right now. So redesigning the technosphere, again, this is borrowing from the Russians. There was a guy named Vernadsky who predated Lovelock, who understood, he came up with our basic modern understanding of the biosphere. The biosphere is not, and life isn't just a passenger on planet Earth. It's been here for, you know, pushing 4 billion years, and it's transformed. You know, the Earth that we see, you know, is obviously geology is at work, but it's also been profoundly shaped and changed by the action of life. So Vernadsky saw that the biosphere and the technosphere had to be reconciled. And I think that's what we had the insight when we called our institute Ecotechnics. So, you know, the blueprint for a successful human future is to rethink everything about our technosphere. Let's not take it for granted. I mean, and I love histories of technology where it wasn't inevitable that they would use fossil fuels to power automobiles. There were other options. It's not inevitable, almost any technology. And I think, you know, again, why I love dismantle and reassemble in a better way. Actually, by the way, at our ecotechnic projects, we have a rule because we like people to be wild and, you know, you've got to express yourself. So we have the saying, you can break anything, but then you have to replace it with something equal or better. So we need to we need to re-examine and dismantle, because a lot of what we do economically and technologically does not make sense. It may make profits and power, but it doesn't make sense for people who want to live with a vibrant and regenerating biosphere. So redesigning the technosphere. So that process of even of designing Biosphere 2, even if we hadn't had a project, was immensely successful because we saw in action the interaction and the education both of the ecologists and of the engineers. And engineers are up to it. And, you know, my God, new generations of engineers who are not, you know, who are willing to say that the emperor has no clothes, and half of our technology may have to be replaced. Why are we so addicted to synthetic chemicals? And the, you know, the other thing, by the way, about that first day back in Biosphere 2 is they put us on a golf cart to take us over to Mission Control for a reception and all that. And we had some solar powered ones, but they put us on a gasoline driven, petrol driven golf cart. And I remember, you know, when I smelled that exhaust and I looked around at my fellow crew members, it was like this absolute disgust. My God, we've been free of cars for 2 years. Why do people put up with this? And by the way, this COVID slowing down of business as usual. I mean, there are apparently blue skies in London. I hope it's not going to go back to the ordinary terrible situation where cars have priority over people and clean air is a collateral victim of our industrial way of moving people around. We need to rethink that. Why put up with it? In Biosphere 2, we had an analytic laboratory. So we could see every trace gas, you know, often in parts per billion, even in parts per trillion. I think, you know, people in every city should have laboratories that every day have the air analyzed and engineers can figure out what is putting those pollutants there. That's one of the things when you do go into a green area, be it, you know, a small park in London or Central Park in New York, you can experience how much better the air is than when you go back into the traffic congested streets. So we have to, you know, stop putting up with, and, you know, we're kind of brainwashed that this is inevitable. This is the price of having technological toys and conveniences. This is nonsense.
I think that seems like a very poignant place to leave it, actually, and a great takeaway for the listeners. Dr. Mark Nelson, it's been amazing having you on for this chat. If you were to leave one last sort of takeaway and any further reading, what would it be?
But anyway, what I would say is don't put pessimistic and gloomy thoughts into your brain. I'm not saying be in la-la land, you know, and I don't mean at all to underestimate the magnitude of the challenges we all face as a human society to figure this out and do it better and live with the world we need. But take optimism and hope in the future and in the part you can play in it as a yoga. Because if you put pessimistic thoughts in there, you won't be motivated to do your part. And I think what we learned in Biosphere 2 is there are no small or insignificant actions. That's true in Earth's environment. And, you know, I'm very partial to some Buddhist teachings. The Buddhist teachings begin with change your way of thinking. So getting out of the illusion, understanding that you are a glorious part of an amazing biosphere and that we are going to make it. Do not lose hope and fall in love with every little piece of the biosphere, including cities. I love cities. I love London, where this podcast is being recorded.
It is. And I feel very lucky to live in such a beautiful green city. It's a fantastic place. So in a nutshell, the world isn't doomed then. You think, given a fair wind and given a bit of a push in the right direction, we might be okay.
We will be okay. We're a survivor species, and the biosphere is on our side. I think I am pushing our limits. The biosphere is on our side. We have allies, you know. We have fellow biospherians, you know, who know a lot, you know, from the microbes, the plants, the animals, the birds. You know, I'm sitting here giving this, talking to you, you know, surrounded by hummingbird feeders. It's really nice. You know, so yeah, never say die. And you know, the Industrial Revolution was only 200 years ago. You know, we're like kids with new toys. So sure, we're making mistakes, just like we made mistakes in Biosphere 2. Any problem that humans have caused, we can solve. Pick up Life Under Glass, new edition, Crucial Lessons in Planetary Stewardship from Biosphere 2. Been a real pleasure talking with you, Matt.
It's been absolutely fantastic speaking to you too. You know, I've had a lot of fun researching Biosphere 2 in more detail, further than Spaceship Earth. And I urge everyone that's listening or watching to do the same. Don't just use the documentary. Get involved with Mark's work. Maybe get yourself a copy of Life Under Glass, because it is, you know, it's got some truly fascinating stuff. And it's not just to do with the experiment. It is very extremely poignant and relevant to this world that we're all living and breathing and walking around in at the moment. So I think that's really, really important to remember.
All right. So I'll sign off as we do here. Adios, amigo.
Adios, amigo, to you too. Thank you so much, Dr. Mark Nelson.
Okay. Cheers.
Cheers. And there we have it. What a fascinating episode of the Dismantle Ideas podcast. Even if I do say so myself, Mark Nelson was honestly an absolute dream to speak to, and I felt like I learnt so much throughout that. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. This has been the Dismantle Ideas podcast. If you like what you heard, please tell a friend, subscribe to what we're doing, subscribe to our episodes. We've also got a YouTube channel now, the Dismantle Ideas YouTube channel. Head over onto that and hit a subscribe if you like. The more the merrier. We've also got a few events and webinars coming up over the next few months, so head over to www.dismantle.co.uk to check some of those out, and hopefully we'll see you at some of those in the future. Got some really awesome stuff lined up over the next few weeks in terms of podcasts, everything from dating and flirting through to psychedelics and time travel cults. So I hope you won't be disappointed by it. Anyway, thank you for listening. We'll see you again soon.